Well, happy Thursday to you. Hope you've had a good week, and we did indeed dodge that bullet called Dorian, did we not, huh? Although our hopes and regards and everything that we can muster going out to the folks in the Bahamas, that was certainly a devastating hit in the wake of Dorian. However, we are on to different topics today on Perspectives from WFSU Public Media, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for joining us via the airwaves and the interconnects that we have today on the internet and all of that. Before we get underway, a reminder, you are always welcome to be part of the conversation via phone and email. The phone number, 850-414-1234. Email perspectives at WFSU.org. And our question of the day, where did the first Floridians come from? Well, that question has really been the driving force behind a series of landmark scientific conferences. And of all places, Monticello, Florida, which a lot of people would not normally think of as a seething hotbed of scientific and research exploration. The genesis of all this goes back to 2012, and these discussions ultimately led to the formation of the Osceola Research Institute to study the origins of human settlement in this area. And it's also rewriting some history along the way. The fourth generation of the First Floridians Conference, which is entitled Old Stories, New Discoveries, is going to take place at the Monticello Opera House on October 4th and 5th. And we're honored to have some of the driving forces behind the conference and the Institute with us here on Perspectives this morning. So we'll go around the table and meet everybody here. First, let's say hi to Jim Dunbar, Florida State University Archaeologist, Chair of the Osceola Research Institute. Jim, it's so good to see you, sir.
It's good to be here this morning.
We got Andy Hemmings, Project Manager of the Osceola Research Institute, also a board member, and has a super cool T-shirt on. Talk about that, Andy. What does it say, since this is radio here?
Well, thank you for having us. It is a photograph of the very large unfinished point called a preform that was found at the Wakulla Lodge site in the 1990s by then-state archaeologist Calvin Jones. It dates to probably in the neighborhood of 13, 14,000 years old, and above it is a slogan that it was his mantra, humus non mentor, the dirt don't lie.
And most of us who have been following those things over the year remember Calvin Jones for his groundbreaking archaeological finding of the site of the celebration of the first Christmas here in Tallahassee as well, back in the winter of what, 1539, I think that was?
Yeah, as part of the DeSoto expedition across the southeast, yes.
Which was incredible. History is just so cool. Jack Carswell is back with us, Vice Chair of the Institute, President for First Floridian Science and Cultural Center, Inc. Couldn't do it without you. Jack, thanks for coming back on deck.
Thank you for having me.
And David Ward is going to keep us in a historical lockstep with what is actually going on here. And David, good to see you, sir.
Good to see you too, Tom. Thank you for letting us be here.
Well, we talked about how this all got started back, oh my gosh, actually certainly preceding 2012, but the genesis of the Osceola Institute goes back to there. You guys are up and running. You got a website. You have a physical plant, everything, Jim?
Yeah, we've made amazing progress in just a few years, I think. And I think we're progressing and not looking back, really. We've had a lot of different research going on. The one I have been involved with and Andy's been involved with is a pretty large operation down at Wakulla Springs, which is wrapped up right now. We hope we might be able to start again in the fall of 2020, but found evidence of Paleo-Indian sites that predate Clovis. So we know they're older than, say, 13,000 years old. He can talk about that, working on a mastodon site. Cave divers have been mapping the cave at Wakulla Springs. Have a historic archaeologist that was out in the field and has a couple of very interesting sites that are late Appalachian, and we're getting OSL dates back on the pottery, some of which are dating like 1537, which is very interesting. And Calvin Jones seems like he found everything. at the same site that I'm talking about where the 1537 date is, he found early style olive jar. So we're not ready to say what that is yet, but there's evidence there of some of the first early Spanish contact. So we found quite a few interesting things, maybe a Seminole Indian War fort, one of the trash pits of a Creek Indian, the canards that dates 1793 to 1812 or a little bit after that, who was allied with, believe it or not, Andrew Jackson against the Seminoles. History is more interesting than you think. Found some chopped planks that looked to be part of an old corduroy road, perhaps, and they weren't saw cut. They were all adz hewn, and the carbon date came back to 1800, which would be the Kennard brothers' age. So we've got a lot of interesting things going on.
Yeah, this isn't just 15,000 years ago. This is the entire warp and woof of that historical span from the first folks almost up to the present day then.
That's correct. And we found one of, I think, Ed Ball's Gordon gin bottles. It dated 1937, was it?
Correct.
Yeah. So pretty much something for everybody there.
Yeah, was there the remnants of a bottle of vermouth nearby, or was that just...
We're not at liberty to tell.
Yeah, go ahead, because this is fascinating. There is so much here that is still to be discovered and that the research teams here are uncovering.
We pretty much have focused on the covers. Wakulla Springs, the things that are in that park, seem to really be one of that handful of very rare sites in North America that has just about everything represented from the 14,000-year-old span beginning at that point all the way up to every page of the latest historic. And we really sort of talked about the beginning and the end, but everything through the span in that 14,000 years is represented as well. But it's really exceptional stuff that bookend the length of historic and prehistoric occupation right there.
And just because that was a prime freshwater source for people, for animals, a gathering place, all of that sort of thing.
Location, location, location.
Yeah, there you go. Well, let's talk about the conference here, because all this and much more is going to be discussed during a very packed couple of days there, October 4th and 5th over at the Opera House. And as you were saying, Jack Carswell, this thing is, I don't want to say spinning out of control, but this is becoming a much bigger deal than probably you guys had originally thought when you set it up.
I think that is right, actually, in this conference when we were talking about it, the concept, and we thought it would be a smaller conference and more focused and locally. And when the academic community around the country became aware of this conference, some of really outstanding, well-known scientists were calling us and wanted to speak, and they were of such renown, we made space for them. And so we're going to have a pretty interesting conference. The fun thing about this conference, I think, is the idea of the old stories. And when you're a youngster, you're trying to figure out, how did this guy get to be president of this company, and how did that guy Jim Dunbar become interested in this part of the country, or how did he get to be a renowned scientist? And so, because you want to tread that path yourself, so part of this conference is to talk about that. Is to talk about, well, I met this person when I was on vacation, and he was telling me about this place over in so-and-so, and I knew his brother because I'd gone to school with him in Alabama. So, because that's the way things happen. And so we're going to talk about some of those kind of things and the discoveries. This is a fascinating conference.
And it's not just for professional research academic types, and it also doesn't cost any money. That's
right.
One
of the things when we started this conference, series of conferences, was that they would be free. Actually, it was Ann Holt's idea. She insisted that they would be free and we wouldn't charge any money. I was kind of opposed to that in the beginning, but she was dead right, is it's an opportunity for anybody who can hear this program to show up and rub shoulders with very learned people and important scientists and address the intellectual part of their life's journey.
Well, and it's also, David Ward, an opportunity to actually witness, in one regard, the rewriting of history. A lot of assumptions that we had for years and years about origins of people in America, certainly in this part of the world, are being changed because of all this.
Yeah, it's amazing that we have sites right in Jefferson County that are proving that some of the initial assumptions are in error or not the total truth anyway. There's a lot more out there to be studied, and it just so happens the Osceola River is like a time machine, and it what falls into it is kept intact. It's a low oxygen type environment, but organic matter doesn't decay in there, so you can go find remnants of mastodons in some of the sinkholes there, and you can still find the stomach contents and the seeds and the plants that they ate and recognize them definitively.
We're talking about history, some deep history, and some more recent stuff, too, here on WFSU's Perspectives. We have members from the Osceola Research Institute. They have a great website, too, if you want to check that out, Osceola Research Institute, one word, .org. And we'll be back and chat some more about the upcoming conference called Old Stories and New Discoveries, happening at the historic Monticello Opera House, October 4th and 5th, a free get-together if you like history and are interested in early origins and a little bit of background of what has gone on in this neck of the woods over the past several thousand years. Can't think of a better place to be. We'll be back and chat more about that right here on Perspectives. Welcome back to Perspectives, and you can always find us online at WFSU.org. Check out this or past programs online at that address. Just go to the website, click on radio, hit local programs, and then Perspectives will be amongst the selections that you can make there. Click on that. We archive past shows, try to have the most recent program posted within 24 hours of when it appears on the radio. Back talking about the upcoming conference in Monticello about early origins, old stories, new discoveries here. And Jim Dunbar has chair of the Osceola Research Institute here. All of this information that we got before the break as to what we are finding in massive abundance, whether it's in the Osceola Basin or Wakulla Springs or whatever. Why is all this stuff still here?
During the last ice age, the Pleistocene, the extreme southeast is recognized as being in a warm thermal enclave. It had more species of animals that hearken out of South America, Central America, the west of the U.S., and the animals that natively lived here to begin with. So there was a real diversity of animals. And if people were around, there was a good reason they were. There was a lot to choose from, I believe. And the environments weren't as harsh as we think they may have been. It was the Ice Age, but that doesn't mean the South was cold, especially in the coastal plain, and especially when the Atlantic conveyor current slowed down. It made the Gulf of Mexico turn into a hot pot, so it kept things warm down here versus if you were above Chesapeake Bay, say, above about, I think it's 36 or 37 degrees north latitude, where the ocean was absolutely frigid, full of icebergs and the whole nine yards. It wasn't necessarily that way down here. There were a lot of fluctuations. But the one thing that interests me, and Andy too, but it doesn't seem like the late Pleistocene was a monolithic thing. You had periods when the water tables were way, way down because there wasn't enough precipitation, but you had periods of time when the water tables were up and everything was flowing.
Well, Andy Hemmings, you said location, location, location. Earlier here, you had ice sheets advancing in from the north, pushing all of the animals and presumably human settlements further and further south. I mean, everyone comes to Florida. We know that, 1,000 people a day. But that actually began back during the Ice Age then. Where else are you going to go? You're not going to go up on a glacier. You're going to head south where the glaciers are not, and they wound up here.
In many respects, yeah. And we have some really interesting examples of that. A little tiny species of muskrat that's still around that doesn't live in Florida, it got too warm here. The Caribbean pine went south because it got too hot here. Just a tree example, but I do this jokingly, and of course this joke doesn't work on radio, but they went that away. And my arms crossed in front of me, pointing in both north and south. The eclectic mix was very rich, meaning there's a lot of different species of plant and animal that not only are not in Florida, but many of which have gone extinct. So it's a bit of a unique laboratory to study those, that they were all here at one time. And that's one of those things that really indicates it didn't just get warmer and things moved north. It didn't just get drier or wetter or whatever. It's this oscillating thing that things change. And that's just sort of the nature of it at all time. But we get to look at things that for a brief period, a few thousand years, we're all here at once in Florida, right when people started to show up.
Oh, right. And so it actually was pretty crowded here at that time, at least as far as the diversity of biology and maybe even culture as well.
A little bit. Certainly in the biological realm, there's something that's really important that we as scientists don't often think of, and certainly the public doesn't think of. In an environment where mammoths and mastodons, you have elephants walking around, they make it really easy to find the water because their biological requirements are about 150 gallons a day. And they clear, they terraform, they manipulate their environment, they make paths. They'll tell you exactly where it is, where the water is. And in a fairly dry, we're high and dry, you know, we'll call us 16 feet above sea level right now. The Ocilla, depending on where you are, is 1 foot above sea level. At the time we're talking about, we would have been 300 feet plus, and the ocean would have been the better part of 100, 125 miles away. So when it was high and dry in the Ocilla and the Wakulla, the water sources there still existed to some extent and really drew all those animals that paved the way quite literally with trails to show you where there was resources readily available.
So it's possible 267 was a mastodon trail at one time.
Out west, the highway system follows what had been game trails that had become Native American trails, that became wagon trails, early roads, and I-70 goes right up a pass that was a buffalo trail.
What is old is new again. Jack Carlson, what's up with this hypothesis? I presume, I hope scientifically I am being accurate about that there was a separate migration from Europe to America across the Atlantic land bridge, just like there was across the Bering land bridge from Asia to North America?
Well, I'm not the one to answer that question. I was present at our last conference when there was a healthy debate with the fellow from the Smithsonian, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, Dennis Stanford, passed.
And it was fun to watch that, the academics weigh into each other. It was sort of a sporting event, actually, and it was fun. But they can speak better to that. I only know the fun part.
Oh, was that what was it, Jim Dunbar? Sort of like an archaeological cage death match?
Well, you know, some people have strong feelings about these things, but Dennis Stanford and Bruce Bradley came up with this theory. It's Iberian, not Siberian. That at least some people came over from Europe, but there wasn't a land bridge. But I talked about 36 degrees north latitude. Above that, you had a lot of icebergs. And Dennis, in his younger day, spent time in Alaska and would go out with the whale hunters and the seal hunters, Native Americans, Eskimos, and they'd go out in the ocean in the massive iceberg drifts. And if a storm came up, they'd find the biggest iceberg, pull their boat up on that, hunker down under the boat. Because it was a big raft of icebergs, they would crunch together, and it wasn't such rough seas, I guess is a way of putting it. And he envisioned that that is how some early hunters got from France, Spain, over to the Americas, and, you know, an alternative route, if you will. So I'm not going to say that's not correct. I think the jury's still out on that, because I think the one thing that has happened since the time Dennis was here is a number of pre-Clovis sites have been found that date anywhere from the 14,000 range. Some go back to, what, 25,000 maybe?
Yeah. The line in the sand has been firmly pushed from 13,000 years ago to at least 14,500 years ago, based on Paige Ladson and a couple of other sites in eastern North America. And the fact that the – I don't know if it's the majority yet, but an awful lot of the very earliest sites are along the eastern seaboard, from Florida up into the Chesapeake Bay area. A recent exception in the last week, kind of in a lot of press, is Cooper's Ferry in Idaho. That is on the order of about 16,000 years old. That makes a little bit better sense of people who are coming across from Beringia. How the earliest sites are along the eastern seaboard makes no sense that if people came from Beringia. They have to have been somewhere else before they arrived in Florida. And until we find those other traces, we sort of scratch our heads and say, well, you know, there's people on the other side of the Atlantic that may have had a reasonable shot of making it here at that time.
So what is the definitive proof then, DNA evidence or what?
Eventually that may be, which brings me to one of the conference topics. This fellow is a brand new hire of the Smithsonian Institute, but Logan Kessler we'll be talking, and he deals with DNA of plants. And as one of his PhD things, I think, at Penn State, he looked at the crookneck gourd, Lagenaria, and it's a late comer to the Americas, period, and came over maybe about 11,000 years ago, and he did the genetic studies and was able to conclude or hypothesize, and I guess in some cases, that probably it got over here by the unique ocean currents at the time, and some of those that floated over actually were viable, and they spread out from the top of South America into pretty much Florida, Georgia. And as Native Americans found them on the beach, they would – these are handy water dippers. And they think that maybe an incipient horticulture built up around them. But it's one of the gourd species that has worldwide distribution. And you can look at the DNA and get a lot of information. But so Logan's going to be coming here talking about that. That's sort of a new story type of thing. Have a lady, Susan Goodhope, who uses cadaver dogs for crime scenes, but has come out on a number of archaeological projects, and the dog helps find fairly old prehistoric burial sites. It's pretty incredible. And you talk about remote sensing, it's remote sensing with a cold nose. But so, you know, we've tried to get this conference, and it's going to talk about Paleo-Indian, but we do try to offset, like Andrew Frank is going to come in and talk about the Native American Creek and Seminole populations of this area, and then it'd be followed by Willett Boyer, who's going to talk about the archaeological evidence for the early Creek and Seminoles. Have three sets of archaeologists that are going to be talking about sourcing the rock that people made tools out of. From the first pioneer, Bob Austin, who lived down in Tampa, to Adam Burke, who's a Texas A&M PhD student that is using new technology to be able to do the same thing, and Jessica Cook-Hale, who is doing a similar thing, but looking at the patina that you find on river-stained artifacts and being able to track it. Well, this is from the Santa Fe River, or this is from the Ocilla, or this is from an offshore site, just based on the patina that the rock takes on because of being in an underwater environment for thousands of years. Joe Kanetch, who's a local historian, I think he personally knew every early land surveyor in the state of Florida, or the way he talks, you would think that, is going to give a talk on the early land surveyors in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. And then Alan Nobles is going to talk about the latest and the greatest land surveying techniques, including LIDAR. So you can do a LIDAR run over an area, look at the bare ground and see every mound and bump. But not only that, you can do bathymetric LIDAR and get the complete channel profile of a river. It's pretty incredible. And I'm just looking down this is going to be a good one. Jeff Mitchum, who's an archaeologist retired out of Arkansas, is one of the few people that I know that got interested in all the early archaeologists as far back as they go. And he's going to talk about the early archaeologists that worked in this area. One was a politician that nominated himself to be the state archaeologist. The governor that just came in got mad at him, fired him, and he had so much political power they had to rehire the guy. But and then Mike Waters out of Texas A&M is going to address all the new techniques you can use in archaeology and have been used in archaeology. So the old story is, well, C.B. Moore in the late 1800s, early 1900s being in this area, that kind of thing.
Well, the archaeology then provides the basis for the history then, I would imagine. That's the founding principle on how did these people get here? What did they do? What activities did they pursue? Is that the whole thing, David, that you're looking at there and then rewriting kind of some of the early history as you get these new archaeological proofs of who was doing what to whom when?
Exactly, and they are constantly revising the history based on new findings that they're coming up with. And one of the interesting people we're going to try to profile in this conference was not a professional archaeologist, but a local man that lived in Jefferson County for about 30 years and just a dynamic individual, Dick Ohms, that he was one of the early divers in the river, and he wasn't just collecting artifacts. He was documenting them and staying in contact with professional archaeologists as well. But just a really dynamic individual. Not only as a scientist, he was a PhD in psychology, but a lot of his work had anthropological and sociological backgrounds to them, and he not only did that, but he was also an artist, and in conjunction with this program we're having at the Opera House, the Jefferson Arts Center will have a profile of Dick Ohms' paintings, sculptures, and photography. So an added bonus there.
Well, that sure is. And given the artistic expression of some of the earliest residents of this area that we are still finding, whether it's shards of pottery or that type of thing, there's a direct link to that past as well. So
exactly.
Yeah, and this was a pretty busy place from what I understand, even back in the days of the early settlement around, DeSoto, and then when Mission San Luis was founded, that this was not an uninhabited wilderness area. This was a pretty busy place, Andy?
Yes. Since DeSoto's time on, and perhaps even before DeSoto a little bit, regular visits, if not occupation, by European, every competing European government that wanted something out of Florida.
Yeah, we still thought there was lots of gold here, apparently. That was the rumor on the street.
But it's always over there.
Yeah. But let's see, one of the archaeologists who had worked on the mission site had said that right down the hill from there, kind of where that new target is now, there was a village of maybe 3,000 Apalachee, a large contingent of folks here in the Tallahassee area of Native Americans that the Spanish, when they came to this area, thought, my gosh, you know, this must be a good place to live because look how many folks are already here.
A little bit of that. There certainly was a considerable Native American population, and of course, that's where the Spanish are going to hang out.
Yeah. And at least until the British came along in 1704, that did not end well at all, from what I understand. Again, if anyone is interested in attending the conference, it is coming up at the Monticello Opera House. It's entitled Old Stories and New Discoveries. This is Generation 4 of the Osceola Research Institute's series of conferences on the first Floridian series that they have been involved with since at least back in 2014. You can find out more at OscellaResearchInstitute.org, and we'll be right back with more right here on Perspectives. Early history is so much fun because it seems as though the further back things are, the more intriguing the search for what exactly happened there. And the deep, dark recesses of history kind of part like, I don't know, the Red Sea, when you have some really expert and adroit folks that are working on uncovering exactly what happened with that history. We got some of the best here. Jim Dunbar, Andy Hemmings, Jack Carswell, and David Ward, all connected here with the Osceola Research Institute, hosting the conference on October 4th and 5th at the historic Monticello Opera House. And Jack Carswell, you were just saying something else we need to cover here.
Well, the kind of interesting part for laymen to look at it. Scholars and historians have a way of is taking the barriers out of time and collapsing time into this sort of continuum. And one of the interesting parts of this conference is the art exhibit that recounts Dick Ohm's involvement in Jefferson County. And the art exhibit primarily is his recording of African-American life in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s in Jefferson County. His paintings reflect that. His sculptures, he was a talented sculptor. He has about 300 photographs in the Florida Memory Bank. And it really was his sort of anthropological interest in all the things we're talking about. In a contemporary sense. So he sort of recorded the life of African Americans prior to the Civil Rights Movement in Jefferson County in North Florida, and that's the thrust of the art exhibit. And he was as interested, however, in the pots and the artifacts that he dove up out of the river. He sort of collapsed time, and so he saw it as one mural. And in a way, the conference is sort of like that, isn't it, Jim?
Yeah, it is.
How do we address today's history? I'm only saying this is kind of a little bit off our beaten path here on our discussion, but there's a lot of controversy going on here in town about whether it's old trees or old neighborhoods or anything else. What do we save from the present to kind of project that legacy into the future?
Should save, right?
Yeah. And is that a discussion that everyone in the community should be involved with?
Absolutely. We have that discussion in Jefferson County, and Jefferson County is unique in this sense that it is a really sort of breadbasket repository of Florida history. And it's almost every step you take, you have something to do with. And in fact, the development of the United States as well, Jefferson County and the people that live there. Were significant in Florida's development and the country's development. and they all rest on the things Andy and Jim have just been talking about. So it is a discussion that we have all the time in Jefferson County, actually,
mm-hmm.
And should have in all of Florida.
Yeah, and particularly, well, it makes it a lot easier, of course, Andy, to do explorations when you have at least a preserve or protected areas, say like Wakulla Springs, where you're not going to have 20-story condos suddenly springing up around the spring itself. But we're still under a lot of pressure here in Florida, as they say, 1,000 people a day moving into this part of the world. And there's the possibility a lot of what was may not be discovered because of that.
It's exceedingly difficult to excavate under 20-story condominiums.
No kidding. I mean, the Tecumseh Indians down in Miami, for instance, they were doing a dig for something along the river, and they discovered this giant stone circle. Of course, that may not have been uncovered had they not been excavating for that thing.
But they actually did tear down a condominium where that was. So that was a case where the site had been frozen in rock, because the limestone's so close to the surface there, but there was black dirt midden and everything that you would find in a black dirt midden just frozen in that rock, which included like fish remains and some artifacts and all the debris from day-to-day life for the Tecumseh Indians that were laid down there. And there are other sites related to it nearby. That often does not happen in this area of the world. You have deep sand columns, usually down like at Wakulla Springs or maybe even over in the Wasissa. And if there was a circle hut of some sort, you may or may not be able to find the post molds to define it. It's more likely up in the Red Clay Hills. So, you know, archaeological sites are like a puzzle, and depending on where you are, you get certain answers, you get certain things preserved that you can make some tests and everything else you do to figure out what in the world was going on there. So it's like a giant puzzle in just about every archaeological site I've ever seen. You get part of the pieces, but not all of them.
Well, I think sometimes that the discussion, we need to continue to have the discussions. There's no one answer. We need the research, right. but we also need to have the discussions. That's what protects us, is to be concerned right. about it and keep talking about it.
Whether we're talking about Florida specifically or anywhere else in the world, the animal remains, the paleontological remains, the archaeological remains, the historic materials are very finite resources. There's only so much of it. So if things are destroyed or just deteriorate naturally over the course of time, and then we've made choices to build monstrous cities and other things, then pave over things, that we lose some more that way. We only discover a very small portion of what was. And that discussion that you're talking about, Jack, about people's involvement today in historic preservation, or what should we preserve, what should we keep, what's important to us now that we want future people to know about.
It's kind of a moving target in a way, right?
Yeah, that sort of compressed time you were talking about, it doesn't end, and we're part of it now as much as any day previous to this was.
Yeah.
And we're trying to find interesting pages that
and that's part of the purpose of the Osceola Research Institute. We was founded as an independent organization, research institute, to do research which provide knowledge to our body of knowledge, and that would make that knowledge available to policymakers and would enhance the discussion. That's what the Osceola Research Institute was founded to do.
And it almost, I don't want to say, flies in the face of that conventional wisdom. Florida has always been a land of reinventing oneself, of fresh starts, of new beginnings, that kind of thing, whether it was folks 13,000 years
Andy
ago.
And Jim find.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they
exactly,
do.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say is if you look at silviculture, which is the planting and growing and harvesting of trees, you can regrow those trees with an archaeological site, if it gets destroyed, it doesn't grow back. So we lose that little part. And I don't think a lot of people understand that. It can be looked at. There are 9 ways to Sunday to do scientific tests on these things. But if you just willy-nilly dig it up or destroy it because you're building something, it's gone. It's never going to come back. And we just lose that much of our heritage, in my opinion.
Or even the context, which is why you can't go out and just pull arrowheads out of the streams anymore. That is against the law. Yeah. Great. Grace joins us here on Perspectives. We sure do appreciate the call. By the way, that number, 850-414-1234. Hi, Grace. Thanks for calling. Welcome.
Yeah, hi there. We're the current owners of Mission San Juan de Ostalaga in Jefferson County. And it hasn't been excavated since Dr. Jones, Calvin Jones, back in the 70s. So we'd like to invite you all to come out and look at our streams and the land and the mission site and help us make some preservation efforts because the place is primarily in timber now. So what I can do is give you my actual contact information off the air. Are you interested?
Yes, it will. You know, this is Jim Dunbar, but I'm not, say, an expert in the mission periods and that type of thing, but one of our board members, Rochelle Marinen, she has a mission in life, and she will be giving a talk at this conference we're having. I'm sure she's interested. We have a Willett Boyer that works for us that's a Cracker Jack historic archaeologist, and that sounds very interesting and appreciated.
Yeah, thank you so much, Grace.
Sure. Well, as I say, I can give the contact information off the air, but, you know, it's been so many years since Dr. Jones was out there. The mission site itself is protected in the sense that, you know, we're not planting trees on it. But just when you walk the land, you know, you're continually finding objects and artifacts, you know, from the indigenous peoples period to the Spanish mission period. So anyway, I'll ring off if you like, and somebody can take my information off the air.
Okay. Well, it's much appreciated that you have that sort of conservation ethic. I appreciate it a lot.
Alrighty.
Okay. Look forward to speaking with you.
You hang on there, Grace, and Lydell will take your information here, and we'll have the folks here at the Institute who are up on all the mission stuff get up with you. And most people know about the Spanish Mission Trail in California, but we had an analog right here in North Florida back in the day. So
right. We were hoping to have Rochelle come over, but she's a chair of the Department of Anthropology at FSU, and her job got in her way today. She is really the one to talk about that. I mean, she knows it like the back of her hand. But, I mean, we do truly have a very unusual and rich cultural resource of a lot of different ages.
Well, and it's good too, and David, what are the holes for as an historian? What do you see as, oh boy, I wish we knew more about this period or this particular group of people? Or there's still a lot of unknown things out there.
Well, one thing that really stands out to me is that during the Spanish period, during the Spanish mission period, that this area was the breadbasket for the Spanish Florida and even Cuba. And the trade that was going on by water, we know that the Spanish brought up the Tocobaga Indians from the Tampa Bay area, and we know they had villages along the Wasissa River and the Lower Osceola. And we think they were used to facilitate trade, not only going ocean-going canoes that went down the coast of Gulf of Mexico, up the Suwannee, around the Santa Fe, so you ultimately can be within by water can be within about 20 miles of St. Augustine if you take that route, and we're absolutely certain they did. They even took large canoes down to with goods that were produced in this area down to Havana in Cuba. So there's a lot of that. There are Spanish haciendas where they had ranches. We think we know where some are. We're interested in pursuing that too. But the missions and the haciendas and the trade are all intriguing areas of study.
So much left to be found. That is, and that's what you see, Jim, is the ultimately the purpose of the Institute is to, that puzzle that you keep talking about, right. Bring those pieces together, uncover new ones, and just make it more and more coherent.
Absolutely. And it's just not archaeology. It's paleontology. It's geology. It's environmental studies. The wealth of information that's in the Ocala, Wakala rivers is going to, you know, if studied correctly, you could reconstruct very precise environments, I believe, from way back when to almost now. We pretty much know what it's like now. One of my hopes is that we'll get enough evidence to make a nomination of places like Wakala Springs and places like the Wasissa and the Ocala to a National Historic Landmark. That's the goal I would like to see. Wakala Springs is already on the National Register of Historic Places, but I think there's enough here and enough dynamics to it to go there. And you've got to collect the information to justify such a nomination, because at that level, it's almost getting into politics, or maybe it is. But anyway.
Well, life is politics. And what do you need as far as Jack, help from just plain folks who suddenly realize that, hey, we have a treasure trove here that is worth protecting, preserving, holding on to?
We do. We need a lot of help. Running the Institute has been fun, or to be a part of it. But it takes money, and it takes talent. We have an associate scholar program. We're interested in additional scholars. We're interested in money to help us fund our activities. We've been lucky to have the state of Florida has been generous in granting grants to us, and private people have as well. But we need fundraisers. We need the means to accomplish our objectives.
And we also need, again, the awareness which is engendered by things like the upcoming conference. Again, folks, if you're interested, it is free of charge. Jim Dunbar.
Just one quick thing. In our Wakala project, we had over 9,000 volunteer hours helping us on the digs. That's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah. If you enjoy digging in the dirt, I can think of no more productive time. So yeah, you may find some things in your backyard, but you'll probably find some more if you contact the folks at the Institute if you really would like to help in that regard, too. Gentlemen, time grows short. Again, we'll give you one more plug here. This is Old Stories, New Discoveries. The conference takes place October 4th and 5th at the historic Monticello Opera House in mighty Monticello. It is free of charge. Some of the top experts when it comes to such things as archaeology and history and paleobotany and physical anthropology and a host of other things. But these folks speak regular plain English. You'll be able to understand what they're talking about, and I'm sure that you will find some fascinating things to take with you. Jim Dunbar, Andy Hemmings, Jack Carswell, David Ward, thank you all for coming on Perspectives today, and we'll catch you during the conference next month.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Perspectives produced by WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. Evan Rossi and Light Overalls behind the glass, pushing the buttons and making it all happen. I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week, we step aside for our fall pledge campaign. In support of all of our program offerings, we hope you'll become a sustaining member of our constant efforts to bring you vital news and information that you find of interest and use. The following week, Perspectives returns with folks from the Holocaust Education Resource Council. Hope you'll be with us then, right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.